Hey, Anna. You hear that sound?
Yes.
It's the sound of Earth. Don't you think?
Sure, one of them.
One of them. There's a lot.
There are. That's true. I would say that's, yeah.
Well, what we're listening to is part of the record that was sent out into space
on the
Voyager spacecraft record. Why is that part the funny part?
It's like, come on.
I know. It's so, we sent an 8-track
the
out
8-track.
And a reel-to-reel laser disc. No, it was a record that they sent out on the spacecraft Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. And these are some of the sounds that are on there that aliens could play on their record player.
Oh, I was going to say, hopefully they have a record player in their spacecraft.
Oh, it's built in. It's built in on the spacecraft, with instructions and everything.
But in English.
Well, there's where we get to our topic for today. We're going to be talking about messages from space how we send them. And the preparation of this record was very controversial because... Uh-huh. How do you consolidate the sounds of our entire planet onto one record set, box set?
There had to be a voting process or something.
Well, it was tricky. But I mean, so if you were going to put some sounds of Earth, what are your sounds of Earth?
Sounds of Earth, like people talking.
People talking?
Yeah.
That's your
general...
Oh,
yeah. That's what I do 95% of the time.
That's every day.
Just talk.
So this nature stuff, just forget this.
I don't know, like running water and birds chirping and stuff. Like, that is too, yeah.
Yeah.
Horns honking.
Well, no, I mean, that's very interesting. So life on Earth for you is talking. That's good.
Yeah, and like interacting.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. No, I guess
we're not all introverts, Dean.
I know. I guess I like the...
I like silence.
I like the wind through the open shutter at the observatory on my mountaintop isolated spot.
Oh,
I guess that's what I hear.
With no one asking you questions or talking to you or the phone.
Nobody saying, Dean, get over here.
I don't sound like that if that's supposed to be me.
Oh, that wasn't you?
It's inaccurate.
All right. Sorry.
That better not be on the record.
That's right. From the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio, I'm Dean Regas, and this is Looking Up.
And I'm Anna Heeman, and we're both from the Cincinnati Observatory. Dean's the astronomer, and I know the truth is out there. On this episode, Amy Shearer Tytle, author of the book Fighting for Space, Two Pilots and Their Historic Battle for Female Spaceflight, joins us during this Women's History Month. So we sent out some sounds.
Yes.
That we think is I mean, that's almost smart of us.
Yeah.
I said it was my idea. Like,
thinking. It was a good job of the Earth to come together and send these sounds of Earth. Now with the current technology, we could, really put a lot of info on these things. It's not like a long play record. We could put a
CD.
Or a whole CD box set of, classic. Pink Floyd plus, whoever else, it could be anything.
Yeah, it could be divided by kinds of sounds.
Right.
Like music.
Right.
Languages.
Yeah. People talking for you. You love the people talking.
I just want to hear people talking.
Yeah.
That's true.
Well, so the reason why we're talking about this today is it's been in the news about something called a fast radio burst, FRB. And so this
it's got its own acronym.
Yeah, I know. It's not the best.
FRB.
I'm not really excited about
You're really like...
So I'm just going to call it fast radio burst,
if you
don't mind. But yeah, these fast radio bursts, this is like this energy that's coming from very, very far away. And most of these kind of, they call them messages, but they're not really messages. They're just like...
How do you know?
Well, that's the debate. So some of them come in really fast bursts, like milliseconds. And so our telescopes can pick these up and they're like, oh, what's that? That's a lot of energy coming from very far away.
Ooh.
But they're always just kind of like little one-off things. But then they found one that repeats. And it's not just a microsecond. It's on for a while, for a couple hours, even a couple days. Well, its sound is kind of relative. It's it's not like it's like got a beat or anything like that to it. But it's these pulses of energy. And so we pick these up, and it repeats every 16 days.
the same pattern?
No, that would, of course, make it cooler. But no, it's not exactly the same pattern, but it's close.
But every 16 days.
But every 16 days, like clockwork, we're ready for more of these signals. And so when we get something that repeats itself, the obvious culprit is...
aliens.
Aliens is right. That is what everybody is saying.
But more specifically, aliens reaching out.
Yeah.
Saying, hey. They're trying to slide into Earth's DMs.
They're trying. I mean, but the 16-day cycle, I mean, that's a long, long wait. I mean, you know.
Maybe they're busy.
Well, it could be. They're very long-winded, maybe. That's what it is. Or they take a while to recover. Well, that's the leading, I wouldn't say theory. I'd say that's the leading off-the-wall answer that everybody's going to.
Are we responding?
Well, this is the problem, is that this is from a galaxy far, far away, 500 million light years away. So the signal traveling at the speed of light took 500 million years to get here. So if we say, cool, back, it'll take 500 million years for them to get that.
Well, that would be the polite thing to do.
Yeah, I think it's
acknowledged, you've been spoken to.
But in reality, this is the least likely scenario that an alien civilization is communicating to us. I know it's a bummer because I would love to hear what, you know, what their sounds of whatever their planet is.
Right.
But it's most likely a star that's circling a black hole or two black holes circling each other or neutron stars or some gigantic thing, because the amount of energy that they're sending out here to reach us at 500 million light years, their transmitter would have to be the size of a planet. So can aliens make a planet-sized transmitter?
Of course they can.
Well, of course they could. And, you know, if you're in science fiction world, yeah, they can do anything in science fiction world. But in the real world, it'd be unlikely. But it does get me thinking, is, you know, so let's say we were those aliens that we could broadcast across all those millions of miles.
Uh-huh.
What would you and a human think is important enough to send them? What would you say?
I would probably say something like, don't try to blow up our planet. I would be like, hey, friends.
Yes.
Everything's cool. I'd say everything's cool.
Yeah.
Don't try to murder us all.
Right.
And blow up our planet.
Well, so then.
But that'd be my opener.
That'd be your opener.
I mean, because sometimes you're going to be like, look, we come in peace, man.
So then would you be a proponent to not send a message at all? Because.
Do we want them to know that we're
here? Yeah. Do we want them to know we're here?
I mean, I'm curious.
Because if you're going to send something out, you want a reply, right?
Absolutely. As you said, it's only polite. Don't leave us on red, aliens.
Right, exactly. So.
What would you want? What would you say, Astronomer Regis?
I mean, no idea. I don't know. What would I send? Because, yeah.
You have a lot of questions.
It's the whole thing. Well, this is what I want to hear your opinion on this.
Oh, yeah.
Because the big question is, well, all right, we can't just speak in English. I mean, we could, but, you know, what's the language? How do you send a signal
emojis.
In a language? Well,
send all emojis.
Emojis would be good.
Here's how I send it. Peace sign.
Okay.
Smile with the little rosy cheeks.
Right.
Thumbs up.
Yeah.
A green earth emoji. Okay.
Yeah.
A heart.
This is working pretty good.
Yeah. Another thumbs up.
No. You can't have enough thumbs up for them, that's for sure.
I want them to really know that everything's cool. And then I probably book in with a peace sign just to be safe.
Yeah. Alien face.
Alien. Well, are those flattering though? That's very derivative.
No, that could
I feel
be...
like they're gonna be like, you know.
We don't all look like that.
That's right.
What they're probably saying.
That's right. I could do peace sign emoji. And a little home emoji.
Oh.
Like,
there you
try to just, a lot of good feeling. Little puppy dog emoji face.
Right.
The alien one, I don't know.
Well, I mean, what if they don't have a face? You know, we could be talking to.
Then they won't be able to see the emojis anyway.
That's a good point. So, but this sounds like completely ridiculous. And
well,
but this is what Carl Sagan and the other scientists did when they made that that record. Is they're like, how do we communicate in a way that anybody could understand? Mm. And so their method was math. We got to use math because that's the universal language. If they can make a transmitter, if they can make a receiver, then they will understand the geekiest of all languages.
Yeah, the aliens are going to be like, what a boring like, we're not going down there.
I know. That's assuming that aliens are like us. And that's a big assumption.
I'm fine with that.
And, well, I mean, I guess if, yeah, if you're the radio signal operator on Earth, you're going to assume the radio signal receiver on an alien world will be just like you.
For sure.
Yeah. I mean, definitely glasses, you know, balding. It's, you know.
I thought you were describing yourself.
Eats the same meal every day.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Short sleeve shirt, we're wearing a tie also.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But this is a tough one. Is how do we.
What's a universal language?
Right. And what are we going to hear if we do hear a signal from somebody else? That's the question. What are we going to be able to understand?
Yeah.
And have we gotten a message that we ignored,
or
we just didn't see it. It's a tough one.
It's possible.
Yeah, because it's you know, it's a big universe, and we can barely communicate with each other on Earth.
That's actually a really disturbing point.
I know.
That we can't even do it with it. Like, I also think that dogs panting would be a cute sound to send to the aliens, like a friendly, and maybe like babies laughing.
Yeah, I
guess. Don't murder us. we're fine. I'm really worried about being
blown up. I guess you
are. I am. But you're right. That's a really, you know, that's a really good point about the world, really, a commentary on the world. We can't even communicate with each other.
I know.
Riga's getting deep.
I know. Well, this is what this fast radio verse has got me thinking. So you're worried about the invasion. I'm worried about them misunderstanding.
Yeah. So you like the math approach?
Well,
it seems to be the
best thing. I mean, if you're going to have something that translates across anything, that you know, like the number pi would be something that you could like relate to them, and because no matter where they are, they're going to have to use pi to figure out stuff. But
now I'm thinking we should send them pi, like send them a present.
Yeah, that would be
from Earth. You know,
yeah, speed
like we got good stuff here.
Pi service.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. There's no way to misinterpret that.
That's right. No. This is delicious pie.
Pie. They're like, oh.
Thank you, Earth.
This is exactly what I want.
I'm not blowing up that planet.
I eat this every day. Pie. How'd they know? March is Women's History Month, so we wanted to celebrate that by hearing the story of two spaceflight pioneers who have not gotten the attention they deserve. Joining us today is author Amy Shira Teitel, whose new book, Fighting for Space, Two Pilots and Their Historic Battle for Female Spaceflight, tells the fascinating story of Jackie Cochran and Jerry Cobb. Well, Amy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, your new book, I mean, just amazing stories here. You're kind of profiling some folks that I'll be honest, I haven't heard of, but reading about Jackie Cochran, her resume, winning all these races, World War II, breaking the speed of sound. Tell us more about her.
Yeah, I love that she was this person that like some people have heard of in a very limited capacity, most people haven't, and I'm like, I get to tell you all the things because like I love her. yeah, she's this really interesting character, and I just kind of describe her as like this epic badass real life Forrest Gump. I mean, she knew everybody. She was involved in like every facet of America for like 60 years, and she came from nothing, and she kind of created herself into the woman that she wanted to be. I just think she's ridiculous that way. She's awesome. She got her start in cosmetics, and that was kind of her way out of poverty in her small town in Florida in the 1910s. And it was actually her husband, before they got married, he said, you know, if you want to sell cosmetics, you got to cover more ground because it's the Depression. Get a pilot's license. And she's like, okay. Because if somebody suggests you get a pilot's license, you obviously just do it. And got licensed in 17 days. I mean, this is a natural aptitude for aviation. And wow. She was licensed in 1932, and by the end of the decade had won multiple awards, all of the sort of biggest aviation awards, the Harmon Trophy, the Collier Trophy. She was renowned as like an excellent aviatrix, and I love being able to use that word.
It is a cool word, aviatrix.
It's a great word. I know, it's so funny. Everyone's like, it's very dated. I'm like, yeah, so is the book. But I like words with an X in it. She led the Women's Air Force Service Pilots in the Second World War. She kind of spearheaded a lot of women in aviation stuff. And, you know, at the same time was buddies with Hap Arnold, saved LBJ's life. Her husband, it helps, was one of the richest men in the country. He he owned, among other things, RKO Pictures for a while before their good friend Howard Hughes bought it, which means she was, you know, rubbing elbows with movie stars and was friends with a lot of really notable people, had this cosmetics empire. She was one of the highest regarded luxury brands in the country in the 1940s. Yeah, she sort of touched a little bit of everything. It's hard to distill her down, which is why she was such a fun character to really dig into and all the nitty-gritty. And the best part is she's a pack rat. She kept everything. And because she was good friends with President Eisenhower, like everybody is, all of her papers exist in the Eisenhower Library. So it's there. Yes. So I was able to piece it all together from her actual words.
That is a seriously amazing life. I mean, just, yeah, I'm like exhausted just hearing it, right?
I know.
Oh my gosh. And then in the, you also talk about Jerry Cobb, who kind of was the second generation or younger than Jackie. Can you tell us a little bit about her as well?
Yeah, Jerry comes into the story. She's 25 years younger than Jackie, and she's, you know, they grew up in very different worlds. You know, Jackie had to figure out how to get people to take her seriously as a female pilot, and Jerry was growing up in a world where it was difficult for women to learn to fly, but it wasn't unheard of, and she actually learned to fly as a teenager. I mean, that's a luxury that Jackie really didn't have. She was working in a cotton mill and then a hair salon. So they're coming up in this very different world, but they're both very much involved in aviation at the time that America switches, kind of make this transition from aviation to spaceflight. And that's kind of where their stories overlap and how their stories overlap. You know, Jerry was, just by virtue of being younger, was the right age and literally in the right place at the right time to take the medical tests that Randy Lovelace gave to the astronauts, the astronaut candidates for NASA. And she ended up taking them, and the media found out and kind of went crazy with the story. And then a lot of hoopla happened. And because Jackie was involved in everything, Jackie got pulled into this one as well.
Well, so how did, tell us more about how the two of them came together and the training to become the first women in space.
Yeah, so the sort of idea of training to become the first woman in space wasn't a real thing that happened, which is why this book was so fun to write, because the story, and I will use very large air quotes here, of the quote-unquote Mercury 13, it gets everywhere. It gets repeated a lot and pretty often. And, you know, effectively, the story goes that there was a group of women that NASA was training in some secret program to be the first women in space, and they didn't go. And none of that is true.
Oh.
So I loved unpacking that and being like, here's why it was all a lie. So what actually happened and kind of how they overlapped is Jerry, through one way or another, the epilogue in the book kind of deliberately leaves you with questions of whether or not her recollection of it is true. She took the medical test that the astronauts took, and Randy Lovelace, the doctor. So this is, by the way, the medical test. You've seen the right stuff. You know that scene where the guys are running down with the Johnny shirts open in the back with the enema bags and stuff. I mean, she did that.
Wow.
Hopefully not running down the hall with an enema bag, but you know, this intense, that whole montage in that movie. It's that intense medical testing. She did it, and Randy Lovelace, whose clinic did it and who ran this testing, announced it in a medical conference. And you know, the same way that the media now here's, you know, the scientists will say, we found more evidence for the existence of past water on Mars. The headline is, there's water on Mars. So when Randy Lovelace says something along the lines of, we put a female pilot through this testing and she performed quite well in the astronaut medical exams, the media said, there's a woman astronaut.
Wow.
And it really became this like intense media sensation that wasn't at all what was really happening. So Randy Lovelace, you know, is a medical professor. He knows, or a doctor rather, he knows that a sample size of one is not good enough for science. So he wants to get more women involved, and he's good friends with Jackie. And Jackie's husband Floyd was the lead donor to the Lovelace Foundation Clinic. So like they're very involved in other ways. Randy asked Jackie if she also knows some women that could be other test subjects, just to get data points. Because, you know, starting anything like this, the world in 1960 is not ready for women astronauts. It's barely ready for space. But getting the data ready means that as soon as someone says, maybe we should look into this, you can just hand a report and say, it's been looked into, move ahead now. So the idea is to gather more data to figure out what's going on and see if NASA's interested, but it's a private program. And Jerry's running around telling everyone that it's a NASA program and that it's astronaut training. And you can even see from the letters that I found that Jackie, oh, thank God she saved it, that Jackie saved, the women all had different understandings of what this quote-unquote program was. Some people were told it was a program. Some people were told it was just medical testing under a private project that wasn't going anywhere. Some were told that they were going to be referred to NASA. There was absolutely no, like, they never met as a group. This wasn't like a little, you know, I joke, they weren't the Sisterhood of the Traveling Space Pants. I mean, they never met. These were women who, some of them knew each other, some of them overlapped, some of them met because their testing was happening at the same time by chance, but they weren't a united group with a leader and with a spokesperson. And, you know, it really became this really messy she said in the media between Jackie and Jerry as the two kind of most vocal proponents. Jerry kind of saying, you know, I want to be the woman in space, so let's get this thing going. And Jackie saying there is no woman in space program because it's not a thing that exists, but we're trying to get a research program done. And the other women just kind of like reading stuff and being like, I don't really know what's happening, but I need to go find a job. So I'm going to go find a job. And it's a lot less cut and dry than you'd like it to be in a lot of ways, which makes it a lot more fun for me.
Well, and so then we fast forward a little bit to the first woman in space is not American, is Russian. Yeah. And is there any kind of feel for how they reacted to that? Was it something to celebrate? Was it something to be, well, what should have been an American? What's the feeling on that?
There was some feeling in the United States after seeing Valentina Tereshkova. So I should say Tereshkova flew in June of 1963, and she did fly in large part because there was so much media around Jerry. The Soviets started paying attention and figured, well, let's just do this whole like publicity propaganda win by launching a woman, and that's basically what they did. There was some feeling in the United States of like, well, this kind of sucks. We were bested again, and we could have beaten them. But then there was the question of, but you know, by 1963, we're already going to the moon, and that's the real goal. Like, that's the important goal. Yeah, so there was some feeling and some reaction, and among some of these women, the feeling of like it should have been one of us. But ultimately, it's like it should have been one of us, but we've got bigger things going on with our space program right now.
Well, this story of these women is incredible, and you know, we're fresh off of Christine Koch serving, you know, the longest female American astronaut, I guess her longest, almost spending a year in space. Are there stories like hers or other stories about women in space or science or history that you'd like to tell, or are you shifting gears a little bit, or what do you have coming up?
Oh, coming up, I don't know yet. coming up is a vacation at some point.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, right. No, I'm not totally sure what's coming up. There's definitely other stories of other remarkable women. I think just having found someone as unexplored and yet as fascinating and just everywhere as Jackie, I think is a hard order to follow. But there's definitely other stories and other women and stuff that are just as worth, you know, digging into and bringing to light and are, you know, undoubtedly just as awesome and fun. I mean, it's amazing too. I love that there's this increased kind of attention paid and, kind of awareness of what women are doing in space. And it's like, we're finally to the point where it's like, hey, look guys, humans can do things and we're all humans, which is kind of like the way we should be approaching science generally, I think, is, you know, we all have different things to offer, and it's great that we're just looking at people as people, because I think that's going to be what ultimately helps remove the systemic sexism that's kind of still lingering. And not kind of at all, it's very much still lingering, let's be clear, but, you know, kind of doing away with the fact that we need to consider stuff. It's like, no, if you're the right person for the job, you're the right person for the job. If it's an all-female crew, awesome sauce. If it's two women on a crew, awesome sauce, because it's the right crew for the job. And ultimately, I think we will get to a point where it's balanced and we don't even notice it. And I think that'll be awesome, because then it's just people for people being awesomeness's sake.
Well, Amy, thanks so much for joining us today and talking about your book. And it's a great read and some great stories about the two aviatrixes. Oh, no. How do you do plural?
Oh, my God. Plural
aviatrixes?
With an X.
Aviatrixes?
Aviatrices?
I think it's aviatrices with an X.
I like it.
Honestly, I would have to double check that before I write it down.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Great. Thanks so much, you guys. Have a great day.
You too. All right. Well, it seems my social media feed is always a buzz with some kind of hoax or an accurate occurrence, description of an accurate, inaccurate description of an occurrence in the sky, or to be honest, even here on Earth. And today, I've got a real humdinger.
Okay.
And it's very timely.
Good.
So one of the more popular viral social media myths that I have seen recently, and it's so viral that NASA itself weighed in. So what I really need is for Dean Regas to weigh in, obviously, on the broom challenge.
The broom challenge.
Now,
oh, my gosh.
Do you know what social media is?
I'm somewhat aware.
Do you know what Facebook... Okay, do you know what the broom challenge is?
The Facebook? I know what the Facebook is,
The
yes.
Facebook.
That's what we call it.
I shouldn't have assumed that you would know what this challenge is. I think I had to tell you about it.
Tell me about it.
Okay. So on February 10th, so not that long ago, supposedly because of the Earth's gravitational pull and the vernal equinox, you could stand a broom upright on its bristles with no help. Like it would just stand straight up.
Whoa.
Like in your kitchen.
Wow.
Okay? But only on that date, according to supposedly NASA. All right? And I'm talking like famous people did this.
Really?
Chrissy Teigen.
Oh, my gosh.
Paula Abdul.
And they successfully did it?
It works, yes. But what people don't realize... Oh, no. Or some people would say, it didn't work for me, but it worked for my friend over here in this, you know. So, I mean, it was a bit... I mean, news outlets are, you know... But apparently... You guessed it.
Yeah.
It's a hoax.
Really? Are you serious?
Way to sound surprised.
Yeah.
But why? Well, it sounds legit. I mean, more legit than some of them
that
I've heard.
What percent of that sounds legit?
I'm just trying to make conversation.
Okay, good point.
My God.
I don't want to shame the people that tried to do the broom challenge on February 10th because of the vernal equinox, which is on March 20th, by the way. But anyway.
It is shenanigans.
It's baffling how some of these things go by. And it's like when I start to get worried that people are not trusting scientists, then they read this and they're like, oh, NASA said I could stand a broom. Then oh, cool. And look, it works. Oh my gosh, NASA's right. This one's a hoax.
Major hoax.
You can stand a broom up anytime if you're really good at it, or if you have a flat enough broom. My broom.
You're like, forget about being on a balance and just get a real flat broom.
Yeah, just get a flat broom. I mean, I got one of those angled brooms, I can't.
Those are arguably better. I was just like, I got really close to the microphone talking about the brooms.
If somebody could stand up an angled broom, that would be pretty cool.
You're like, then tag me on Facebook.
Let's talk. I think that would be a good challenge if you could do that. But isn't it amazing how certain things could go out there and just like people do them and they're like.
And NASA had to be like, hey guys.
I know. When it gets that far.
It's crazy.
I mean, this goes back to the egg, you know, standing egg on the equinox thing. That eggs will stand up on the spring.
Like stand
equinox.
Up the tall.
Yes. Yes. And that is that's a big myth that's been going on for probably decades, if not more than that, you can do that on the equinox. And so people try it out and they're like, oh man, I can't get my egg to stand up. And I was like, yeah, it's pretty tough. And then the people that can stand them up, there's a trick.
Oh, what's the trick?
You put very little fine sand or salt down on the table, and you actually put the egg on the salt to balance it, but you can't see the salt, so it looks like it's balancing.
Clever.
The hoaxsters are clever, but I'm smarter.
I was going to say, I'm just going to say you're cleverer.
No, because I just did it myself.
You're like, no, I figured it out.
When in doubt, test it out. That's always
good. Oh, nice. Ooh. I like a little rhyme.
Yeah. Where'd
that
come
from? Trademark that before it gets around.
Trademarked.
That's good.
Okay.
That was huge. We had to talk about it.
No, that was everybody. Yeah, you're right.
I mean, the news was reporting on it. It was like, holy crap.
Oh, I don't know if there's room to get the NASA response in there.
What did they say?
They were basically like, stop being dumbasses.
NASA said, while this hoax was harmless, It also shows why it's important for all of us to do some fact-checking and research, including checking in with @NASA on Twitter and NASA.gov for real science fun facts before jumping into the latest viral craze.
I did see that. I thought that was really funny. Yep. And a great teachable moment.
Yep.
They could have been like, stop being so stupid.
Right. That's God. What I usually say.
They also tweeted a video of astronaut Alvin Drew and scientist Sarah Noble responding by doing it on February 11th.
Oh, yeah.
And they say, quote, showing that basic physics works every day of the year, not just February 10th.
That was good. A little snarkier.
I like that one.
Well, that's it for this episode of Looking Up. Thanks to Amy Shira Title for joining us to talk about her book, Fighting for Space. You'll find a link to the book on our website, wvxu.org.
This is episode 65. Can you believe it's 65?
I can't.
Our podcast, Looking Up. So, if you've just discovered us, you've missed some great guests and conversations. You'll find all the archives of all of our past episodes at wvxu.org/lookingup.
You can subscribe to Looking Up wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're an Apple Podcast user, we'd really appreciate a rating and comment. That helps others find us. And I love compliments. Dean knows that.
Oh, most definitely. 65 compliments every time.
That would be so
great. This would be the 65th.
Yes.
We're always looking for great guests or topic ideas. So if you have one, definitely let us know. We're on Facebook and Twitter, or drop us a note at lookingup@wvxu.org.
Our theme song and additional music is by Y, that's W-H-Y ? From their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recordings and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds is our producer, Josh Elstra is our engineer, and Jim Nolan provides additional technical assistance.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Anna Heeman.
And I'm Dean Regis. Keep looking up.